Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. I want to congratulate Olivus Anon Legal Services for Prisoners with Children for the really informative and powerful conference for human rights for formerly incarcerated and incarcerated people's movement. It was really, really powerful. People were in Oakland Sunday and Monday, September 20th and 21st, from all over the country. And it was very, very powerful. So congratulations. Looking forward to seeing sort of what further actions are going to come out of the Western Regional Conference, and keep you posted. I am going to play something from the archives, and I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to play. And while I figure this out, I will, technology is not catching up with me. I will, let's see. Matatu Film Festival is kicking off here in Oakland today, and that's going to be really exciting. And then next month, the Mill Valley Film Festival is going to be occurring, and they've got some great films. One of the films, A New Color, is featuring artist Edith Boone, or Edie Boone, and it's directed by Mo, who is a new director, and saw a little preview of that this past weekend at a fundraiser, and I'm really excited. It's going to be opening, I believe, on October 10th, and it's going to have two screenings. So I think, and there's a film that's going to be opening on the 10th called Gladdy Gladdy. It's going to be opening at the Opera Plaza in San Francisco. And it looks at obstetric fistula. Really, really powerful film. Definitely don't want to miss that. I think I will play this interview. It's called Africa is More Than Ebola. So it's still apropos. So that's what we're going to have for today's show. Tune in on Friday, and hopefully we'll be able to have our guest, Kwame Shrugs, founder and executive director of Alchemy, Inc., join us to talk about his program. Peace and blessings.
Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we're joined in the studio with two esteemed people who are doing some work around, sort of doing some education work around the Ebola virus. And there's this great program that's going to be happening in Oakland next week called Africa is More Than Ebola. So I want to introduce my two guests, Clementine. Clementine, how do you pronounce your last name?
Nseikala? Yeah, that's pretty close. Yeah.
Pretty close. Okay. All right. And Clementine is the program coordinator for Africa Advocacy Network, one of the presenters of this program that I mentioned that's happening next week. She's originally from Democratic Republic of the Congo, or the DRC. She's fluent in English, obviously, French and Lingala. She holds a Bachelor's of Arts in Politics and a minor in Sociology from UC. Is that Santa Cruz?
Yes.
Okay, nice place. Great folks there. Like Angela Davis's program, History of Consciousness. Like, ooh.
Yes.
Yeah, it's a nice place to ride your bike, too. Yeah. And I was reading that you're currently in your last year of a master's program in public administration at San Francisco State University.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I just finished my test last night.
Last night? Oh, wow. How'd you do
that? Yes.
do you think you did?
Well, I feel pretty good and relieved. At this point, I'm just hoping for the best.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, we definitely gonna send a lot of light and love your way. Of course you did.
Yeah.
Well. So Ms. Clementine holds a Bachelor's of Arts in Politics and a minor in Sociology. As I already mentioned, she most recently worked as an event and outreach researcher for the Center on Contemporary Conflict at the Naval Postgraduate School. Where is that?
In Monterey.
Oh, okay, okay. You like it down there by the water, huh? Santa Cruz, Monterey.
Yes.
And now the San Francisco Bay. We got water here.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you coordinate Africa Advocacy Network's activities, including fundraising, grant writing, outreach, and communication, and direct assistance to clients. So welcome.
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. You're welcome. Oh, I'm happy that you could fit me into your busy schedule, considering, you know, the stresses that you're under presently, academically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Srinam Shamsunder, our illustrious physician guest, completed his residency in internal medicine at Harbor UCLA Medical Center in June of 2008. As a physician who trained at a public hospital and has provided medical care abroad, Sri is interested in the delivery of comprehensive health care in resource-poor settings. In addition to his clinical work training medical students and residents on the medical service at UC San Francisco, he spends much of his time abroad. In 2009, Sri spent 5 months in rural Burundi and Rwanda with the organization Village Health Works and Partners in Health. Oh, that's wonderful. I know Partners in Health. They're great. providing comprehensive primary and HIV care, as well as designing innovative clinical programs. Following the 2010 earthquake in Haiti, he led a group of Harvard surgeons in Western Haiti, or Haiti, providing medical and surgical care in the immediate aftermath of the disaster. In 2012, he was a Fulbright Nehru Scholar to India, studying innovations of care among tribal health organizations throughout rural India. In the last several years, he has split his time between UC San Francisco, Liberia, Haiti, and India. Currently, he is co-founder of HEAL, H-E-A-L, initiative, which aims to support workforce capacity in limited resource settings, both in the United States and internationally. So welcome, Sri.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. So I don't know how you all want to go with regards to talking about the program and talking about the press conference on December 3rd and talking about Ebola and how Africa is more than Ebola, certainly. And so anyway, I don't know, how do we want to start, Clementine? Do you want to tell our audience about the program, and then we could talk about, you know, what is Ebola?
Yes, you know, I think that the way that we have talked about Ebola, especially in partnership with Dr. Shrim, is that, you know, I have mainly talked about the stigma and the community realities, and Dr. Shrim has talked about the medical, because I feel like one of the causes of this spread of the stigma is the lack of direct communication and involvement of communities. So that's kind of like what we have been trying to do. So we can definitely start by just talking a little bit about the African community in the Bay Area, and then proceeding to talk about Ebola, the press conference we had on Wednesday, and Dr. Sherry will talk on the medical side of Ebola and his work in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Sure. But why don't you tell our audience about the program that's coming up so they can make sure they're there?
Yes. So on December 13th, the African Advocacy Network, in partnership with Priority Africa Network in Oakland, we are co-sponsoring an event on Ebola. And this will be a follow-up on the press conference we just had on Wednesday. And this will be more community-based, community-centered, and we are hoping to have a high turnout from community leaders in the African community, but it's also open to the general public and the media interested in seeing how the African community is coming together to deal with the stigma that our community members have been facing. So that's December 13th in Oakland, and you can log into the African Advocacy Network website or at Priority Africa Network website for more information. And we also will have the flyer available on our website.
Mm-hmm. So where is the event going to be taking place and what time is it?
It actually will be taking place in Oakland. Let me just pull the flyer. Was, you know, since I know the office, I go there without actually remembering exactly where the office is. But I will provide that information during the show.
Okay. All right. Super. Okay. So it's now the time when we talk about what is Ebola?
Sure.
And, yes.
Okay. I want to make sure we have the dance correct. Yeah. what's going on with regards to the capacity building around these various countries being able to handle the virus as well as prevent it from spreading.
Sure. So just as way of background, Ebola is it's a virus that was, I think, first discovered in the 1970s, like 1976 in Zaire. And since then, you know, there's been several outbreaks that are mostly rural, mostly in poor populations. And by far, the 2014 West African outbreak has been the, you know, by far the biggest outbreak, and has moved into the capital cities in, you know, the three major countries that are affected are Guinea, Sierra Leone, and Liberia, and a couple other countries that have been involved, like Mali and Nigeria and the United States and Spain. But, you know, when we think about Ebola, it is a virus, and there's a lot of medical, medical pathophysiology that I could talk about the virus, but it's really the epidemic that we're seeing is a symptom of very poor public health systems in the three most affected countries. So if you look at Nigeria, for example, Nigeria had Ebola and has eradicated it. They had about 16 or 17 cases, and they were able to spend a tremendous amount of money, track down all the contacts of the cases, and essentially eradicate the disease from their country. And in Liberia and Sierra Leone and Guinea, that hasn't been the case. And if you look at Liberia, where we've worked for 4 or 5 years, up to this point, and partner with the government there as well as a local organization, they had about 50 public health workers public health doctors for a population of 5 million people before this outbreak happened. So, the amount of health professionals that were there to kind of take on Ebola was very, very minimal. And in the United States, in comparison, you know, there's something like three doctors for every 1,000 people, and there's 172 fold difference between the United States and Liberia. So I think that we're seeing Ebola thrive in these countries where the public health system and the infrastructure, you know, when we talk about the things needed to fight Ebola, it's really space, systems, staff, and stuff, essentially. And if you don't have the systems and the stuff and the staff to really address it, you're going to have the reality that we're seeing with this West African outbreak in 2014.
Wow. So how are these the deficits given the economies of these nations that are hardest hit? How is this being addressed? How can people help that don't have skills?
Sure. So I think that, there's the short-term response and there's the long-term response. I think what Clementine was saying of involving communities, that's important whether you're talking about the Bay Area or you're talking about Liberia. And so, in the short term, I think it is important to have the Ebola treatment units up and running in places all around the countries of the three most affected areas. And, when we talk about Ebola, I think a lot of people just assume that it's a death sentence. But, if you look at the expats that were infected with Ebola and came to the United States, the death rate is not that high. We had Mr. Duncan in Dallas that died, and a lot of the nurses and a lot of the physicians that were infected actually got better. And so when Ebola comes up against modern medical care, I think we don't know what the mortality rate is going to be. And so in this outbreak, it's been 65-70% of people that actually get infected with Ebola die from Ebola. But we are starting to see, I just got an email from my fellow that works, with me at UCSF. She's on the ground in Rivercrest County in Liberia. And the Ebola treatment unit there just had 8 people that were infected with the virus. 6 of them walked out completely cured and essentially, was for the community to see that 6 people spread the message that if you come to the Ebola treatment unit, if you have good care, you have a good chance of getting better. I think that's a very powerful message from, for the community. And up until, whether it's the HIV virus or it's Ebola, if you don't have options for care, why would a population or why would anybody go and seek care in a place that you feel isolated, that everybody's, wearing masks and it feels like a cold environment and you end up not having any better chance of survival? So what we're trying to do in these countries is really set up the short-term infrastructure to respond to Ebola, and then the long-term response that, whether it's Ebola or malaria or tuberculosis, we need kind of the staff, the systems, and the stuff to really stop these things from killing people when they don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, is this a part of the work that you're doing through HEAL or sort of developing capacity and under resourced areas of the world and country, this country as well as the... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's correct. I think that the HEAL initiative is really a long-term, longitudinal capacity-building effort. So we know that there's not enough health professionals in places that need them most. We know that the 90% of the world face kind of the burden of disease, but all the medicines and a lot of the health professionals are concentrated amongst the 10% wealthiest. So we call that the 90-10% divide, and so we know that there's not enough health professionals in very poor places. And so our goal is for the Americans that want to work in those places, it's not, you know, it's not enough to kind of show up in Haiti or show up in Burundi or Rwanda or Liberia and say, you know, I'm well-meaning and I want to be of help. You need specific training. And for the health professionals, our Liberian colleagues, our Rwandan colleagues, our, you know, those colleagues, how do we give them the support to stay in the public health systems to really have the skill sets to do the work that they're trained to do and want to do? You know, a lot of them are exceptionally committed, you know, even in this outbreak, at the risk of death and so many health professionals dying. Our colleagues in Liberia show up day after day after day, and they need the equipment, they need the training to really do the work that they are committed to do. And so our goal is to support Americans that want to do this work by doing it well and thoughtfully and with the approach that is historically based and understands the local context, and then support health professionals that want to do this work that are from those countries so that they aren't part of the brain drain where, you know, they're so frustrated that they're in a public health system and they don't have the opportunities to practice their craft in a meaningful way to improve their career prospects and really grow in their specialty or their field, and they end up leaving to South Africa or Canada or England or the United States. And so that's what Heal Initiative is trying to address.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Clementine, why don't you talk a little bit about Africa Advocacy Network and what's happening with families here who have families in, you know, the affected countries, specifically, you know, Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. And I know that in the press conference, I noticed that there was a person who was going to speak about stigma.
Yes. Yeah, so briefly I will introduce the work that the African Advocacy Network does and the African community in the Bay Area. So the African Advocacy Network was founded in 2009, and we provide direct legal and social services to Africans and Afro-Caribbeans in San Francisco and the wider Bay Area. And actually, I spent the summer in the Democratic Republic of Congo doing an internship. And while I was there, I was aware of the spread of Ebola in Liberia and Guinea. And even being in Africa, in the DRC, I felt like Ebola, I was aware of the distance and the locality of Ebola being in those three countries as opposed to being in the DRC. So coming back to the States in late August, I still associated Ebola being in Africa. And once we had the first case in October, I still had that sense that Ebola was very centered in Africa. But then I started getting calls from community members sharing their stories. And at first, I just assumed that the stigma was more prevalent in the East Coast since they have larger African and Afro-Caribbean communities. But once we started getting calls, when we started having conversations with other African communities and churches to see if they have seen any changes in their communities. And from those conversations, in addition to the gentleman you mentioned who spoke at the press conference, we have also heard stories from African business owners whose businesses are affected because people are afraid to go to their care places because they're associating them with Ebola. And about 2 weeks ago, I spent an entire day at a hair braiding place in Oakland. Before the stigma of Ebola, this particular place used to see 2 to 3 clients per day, because branding is pretty time-consuming, so 2 to 3 is a lot. And on weekends, you know, she had upward of 4 to 5, which allowed her to have 2 to 3 employees. But on that particular day that I spent, she had 2 customers, and the 2 customers bought 2 pieces of jewelry, which, you know, which were pretty inexpensive. And I, while I was there, since she didn't have any clients, I decided to get my hair braided. And at the end of the day, if I did not go to get my hair done, that business would only have generated $25 for the entire day. And this is not the only business. I've talked to 3 other hair braiding places in Berkeley and in Oakland, and they are telling me the same story. Even here in San Francisco, another hair braiding salon owner has told me that people are asking her, where are you from? When was the last time you went home? How often does your family visit you? All those questions that they've never had to face before until now. And just yesterday, a client saw an article in the Chronicle about the press conference that took place on Wednesday. She called me and told me about her experience with Kaiser Permanente. She's originally from the Ivory Coast. She's 6 months pregnant. And she was just sharing with me that every time that she goes to Kaiser for her monthly checkup, they always ask her, have you traveled to West Africa? When was the last time you went to Africa? And even when she hands them her card visit, they don't take it from her. They ask her to swipe the card. And when she complained to her doctor, the doctor simply told her, oh, this is just a policy that we have in place against Ebola. We do it to everyone. But based on her feedback, she's only noticed them asking Africans to swipe their cards and not other patients who are not African or can be assumed to be African. So what we're seeing really is, you know, people being mistreated in receiving services, but also people being mistreated and as a result are losing jobs and are potentially losing the ability jobs, because we are only aware of the stories of people who have come forward. We don't know what is truly happening to people who are keeping silent. Yes. So that's why we really, you know, we put the story out there. But really, you know, going back to the upcoming event on December 13, this is really it's a community town hall, and we'll have a panel discussion and community forum. And it's taking place at the Priority African Network office at 6501 Telegraph Avenue. In Oakland, California, and it's from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. Light refreshments will be provided at 3, and the event will start with an interfaith prayer. And the panelists for the event will be Dr. Shirim, who is with us today, and Salome Lema, who is the founder of African in Diaspora and AfricaResponse.org, and Chief Joseph Musa from the Ngloma Sierra Leone community, and Vukani Mawutu Choir. And again, this event is co-sponsored by the African Advocacy Network, African Communities Together, Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Global Exchange, the Global Fund for Women, Inga Congolese Community, International Development Exchange Organization of African Students at UC Berkeley, the Gloma Sierra Leone Community, USA for Africa, and U.S. Africa Network. So it's truly a coming together of different African communities. So please join us if you can.
Yeah, it's quite impressive, the various organizations that have come together, you know, to talk about this this crisis, this health crisis that is affecting not just, you know, health, but it's also affecting the economies of Africans, not just in Africa, but throughout the diaspora. And I wanted to also give people the phone number for Priority Africa Network. It's area code 510-652-1493, 510-652-1493. And I believe this event is free, right? Because I don't see a price anywhere.
Yes.
Okay.
It is free.
All right. Yeah.
No, but we want it to be accessible.
Uh-huh. Awesome. Yeah, and priorityafrica.org is another way you can see the lovely flyer. And give your website again, Clementine.
The African Advocacy Network's website is aansf.org.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how does one contract Ebola? How is it spread? Is it casual contact, or is it more invasive than that?
So I think it is very much more invasive than that. You look at who's been most affected by the Ebola virus in West Africa. It's really caregivers, health professionals that are exposed to body fluids, and caretakers that are, you know, mostly women and family members that are taking care of the ill that are infected with Ebola. So, you know, there's a couple studies that have come out. You know, there's one in a very well-renowned journal called the New England Journal of Medicine that looked at, you know, a lot of the Guinea outbreak and patients without fevers that, or even low-grade fevers, did not have, you know, were not infectious. So we know that the Ebola virus is not, unless you have a fever and you're starting to get quite sick, you're not infectious. So people without fevers are not infectious. And then the sicker that you get, the more infectious you are. So Mr. Duncan, who was in the Dallas hospital, exposed a lot of health professionals and various people the first time he came into the hospital, and none of those people got infected with the Ebola virus. So it's really like vomit, a lot of saliva, diarrhea, those kinds of things have a lot of the Ebola virus, but casual contact, you know, is just not going to be the way that you transmit. And a lot of people that are sick enough to transmit the virus are not healthy enough to go out in public. So, you know, you're not going to catch it like that. But I think, you know, the Kaiser example, you know, my wife is pregnant right now, and I think that we go to Kaiser and they ask her as well about the 21 days. So I think the incubation period is 21 days, that if you've been in West Africa, and I think that we need to not bulk all Africans into recent travel to West Africa. And I think it is reasonable to question health professionals or people that have recently been to the three most effective areas. And I think our government is screening people through five countries, and there's a lot of provisions by public health officials to really watch people that have any exposure risk. And I think what we're seeing in the Bay Area is kind of a paranoia that is not helpful and actually hurting people's businesses. But from the public health infrastructure, I think, you know, at UCSF and at Kaiser, we do need to know if people have recently been to West Africa and had fevers that can definitely keep our population safe. But I think this idea of hair braiders transmitting the virus is completely unfounded, and I think that kind of stigma not only hurts businesses and hurts the African diaspora, but is potentially dangerous for, you know, the spread of the virus, where there is kind of misinformation and ignorance about how it's spread.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. Wow. That's really something that someone wouldn't take your credit card come a time if you had to swipe it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, they claim it's a policy, which I do understand, but when you observe that other clients are not being treated the same way, then you start to wonder, am I being treated mm-hmm. like this because I am African?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I think that is, you know, like that, you, when I was in med school when 9/11 hit, and it's this continuous, you know, I'm a dark-skinned person with a bald head and a goatee, and, you know, it's just, it becomes this, even if it's for legitimate reasons, there's this second-guessing because there is this level of being stigmatized and in numerous places. So legitimate concern ends up, you know, making you feel like it's not legitimate. And I think that's where stigma is really painful and really hurts, because even legitimate concerns for public health reasons are approached with suspicion because that there's so much stigma that is completely unfounded. And so I think that, you know, it might not be a great analogy, like, you know, the 9/11 paranoia with terrorism that a lot of young Muslim and South Asians faced, and Ebola with West Africa. But I think that it has some parallels.
Oh, yeah, most definitely.
Mm-hmm, certainly. Yeah, I was wondering in closing if you all could speak to just sort of the spirituality connection with healing. You know, Western medicine is, how Western medicine is being, I guess, utilized in other healing systems, because different communities have healing modalities and methodologies that are not completely in sync all the time with Western medicine. And I think overall the health of a community is best when this is recognized and the strengths of both are used to optimize, you know, whatever sickness there might be. And I was wondering how you work that in your infrastructure building. And then secondly, my second question is, once again, those of us here in you know, the Bay Area and throughout the country that have no skills, like, I'm not a doctor, but I'm concerned. And I want to know, like, how can we help, like, you know, sort of get these you know, protective clothing and gloves, and, you know, maybe fund a physician that wants to go but can't afford it. And I don't know. I don't know if such a physician exists. But anyway, I was just wondering how we could help, you know, in these various places where the reason why the disease is moving like it's moving is because there's not enough money, you know, within the government to be able to adequately address this illness.
Sure, I can start with the second question, and then Clementine, maybe you can talk about local healing traditions, and I can speak to that as well. But we partner with the Ministry of Health in Liberia, and we work with their organization, Last Mile Health, and their organization is accepting donations, and I think would be a great organization to donate for the long term. We talked about the HEAL initiative. So there's our website is, you know, healinitiative.org, and we're actually running kind of a crowdfunding campaign that if you're so inclined, you could donate to that. That would kind of help this capacity building effort for Ebola and other diseases. Clementine, if you want to talk about some of the local healing traditions, but from my perspective, I think it's not either or. It's always kind of an and, because if we as Western trained American doctors kind of come in and impose certain ways of looking at health, like your patient population will essentially say that they're not going to traditional healers, but you know, all of them are, and you need to kind of collaborate and work with them, because they can work kind of side by side. And I think there's been places that we've worked in Haiti and in India that there's a relationship that forms where there's certain things that the traditional healer takes on and the patient community feels very comfortable with, and the traditional healer will kind of refer some very complicated cancers or infections that they feel like they can't handle. And so there becomes kind of this collaboration instead of this antagonism, because a lot of these communities have deep traditions of healing that I may not be trained in and may not understand, but have validity and need to work side by side with some of the Western approaches that we're trained in.
Yeah, and the community side, since I also am not medically trained, the only part that I can speak of is at least here, a lot of recent African immigrants that we've seen at our organization have an intense mistrust of the medical institutions, and I feel like part of that is also based on the fact that we don't have as many medical or established adequate medical infrastructures in African countries. I mean, I can speak for the Democratic Republic of Congo, because that's where I was born and recently visited. And how this is affecting our ability to deal with Ebola is that we need to work on educating the public and working with people to encourage them to get involved in organizations like the HEAL Initiative, which, in addition to providing medical staff, they also promote the use of basic chlorine to wash hands, or using gloves, like little things that the rest of us here can directly contribute to either the HEAL Initiative or other organizations that are also participating in the Ebola Community Town Hall on December 13th, like the AfricaResponse.org, are doing all those different efforts to try to really get communities here to organize and contribute directly to efforts taking place in Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, one thing that I'll say is that it would be great if the African diaspora kind of engages with health professionals that are trying to do this work in, you know, whether it's Liberia or Rwanda, and because, you know, if you look at the history, it's obvious why people are deeply skeptical about white people coming to Africa, and even if they're not white, Americans coming, and the history of kind of Western involvement in a lot of these countries is not exactly, you know, shining. And so the deep suspicion, I think, is very much warranted, and so we have to kind of shift that conversation. And we saw in Guinea where health workers were attacked by the community, and unless there's kind of deep engagement and trust with and relationship building with the community in the long term, you know, it doesn't matter how good our medical care is and how modern it is if that trust is not there, you know. And I think one of the things with the HEAL Initiative that we would really encourage is if there's African diaspora members or people that are still deeply engaged in some of the countries that we work in that could help guide our work, because you know, I think it is kind of a interdisciplinary across boundaries conversation, and it's really 80% of this work is relationship building, because
Wow, this has been a really, really wonderful conversation, and unfortunately I'm going to be out of town next week, so I'm not going to be able to come. But hopefully we'll be able to continue the conversation, and I went to the website for Last Mile Health, and definitely going to make sure that people know about that particular organization, because when people want to make donations, it's kind of hard to find like the right organization that's community-based and grassroots.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy to have this recommendation for Last Mile, as well as, you know, the healinitiative.org, because, you know, we know where you live, you know, Sri. So yeah, so we could like get, you know, regular updates and things like that, and your website is just simply fabulous with the stories and the photos and all that. Both of them are. So, and as well as, you know, what you've been doing at Africa Advocacy Network, which has been around for a minute now. I remember having the director on quite some time ago, so it's really great. Yeah, I met him at, I think it was a Priority Africa Network event. Oh, man, it was too long ago. It was, it was great. So I'm really happy, you know, that we're having this conversation, you know, as a diaspora citizen myself. And I'm always happy to find out, you know, from the people that are on the ground sort of what's going on. And I hadn't realized that the stigma that, continental Africans were experiencing, you know, just in the marketplace because of Ebola. Like, wow.
Yes.
Yeah. And I think the parallel with 9/11. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the parallel with 9/11 is quite apropos, because I remember, like everyone, Latinos, South Asians, like everybody was suspect at one time, you know, right afterwards as being a terrorist. And, you know, I'm still on list because of my name.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you both so much for joining us, and continued success in your great work. And again, I'd love to have you on again to talk about, give us an update on what's going on, and other ways that we can be of assistance, those of us that are concerned, and hopefully that's everyone.
Yes, for sure. I mean, thank you for having us, Wanda.
Oh, you're quite welcome. You all take good care.
Thank you, Wanda. Okay.
You're welcome. Peace and blessings.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye. So we are going to, I'm going to play a little bit of an interview that I had with with Latanya Tigner, talking about the Rites of Passage program at Dimensions Dance. It is 20 years old this year, and there's a special program on Sunday at Castlemont High School. And so we don't have a whole lot of time to share, but I'm going to give you about 13 minutes before our next guest join us. And if you want to hear the entire interview, that was on our Wednesday program. We had a special time. It was 9 o'clock. So you can hear the entire interview with this wonderful artist and teacher and mentor, Latanya Tigner. Black Arts and Culture Program of the African Sisters Media Network. And this is Gina Breedlove, Breathe. We're going to finish listening to that. And then we have a wonderful guest, Tanya Tigner. She's going to be talking to us about the Rites of